Hello and welcome to the Rogers Brief. It is the first days of spring here. I'm actually recording this on March 21st. I'll release it tomorrow, Friday, March 22nd. As it so happens, I'm going to be at St. Evex for two different events. Tomorrow in the morning, there's a conference on forensic psychology, and that is being put on by Dr. Margot Watt, professor of psychology, forensic psychology at St. Evex. And really interesting looking program there. And then in the afternoon, it's German Day at St. Evex, so that's always an exciting event or fun. Lots of good music and food and presentations from the German classes there on the culture and life and accomplishments of Germans. So lots to do tomorrow. And actually Saturday, I'm doing a pitching clinic, actually taking lessons on how to do a pitching clinic from legendary Nova Scotia pitcher Mark Smith, Sports Hall of Famer, multiple time national and international champion. So we're going to spend some time with Mark Smith on Saturday. So I figured I'd record this today. If anything comes out in the next day or so that is groundbreaking or anything that's going to be missed, well, hopefully I'll pick up on it on the Sunday night show. Actually, not this week, but next week, or else next week's program. Or follow it on Twitter and all that stuff. If something major happens, I'll be sure to comment. So this week, I want to cover a number of national stories that really caught my eye. I'm going to focus towards the end of this on there was an appeal from the federal government of a decision from the federal court on judicial appointments. And so this really pits the Prime Minister against the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada in a really interesting way. It hasn't gotten a lot of coverage in the news, but it's seems like a major dispute between those two individuals and entities. Then I'm going to talk about the Nova Scotia Police Review, which and we know now who is going to be part of that review and who is on the committee and some of how that's going to look. And so I'll get to that towards the end, but I've got some other things I want to talk about too. I'm going to start off just covering some things I've mentioned here and some updates. This situation with the school shooter and his parents being charged out of Michigan, that has there's a new development there. A teenager, he's now 16, was 15 at the time, charged with attempted murder at a high school in Halifax in Bedford, CP Allen. That student has now pled guilty to some lesser included offenses, so discuss that. The Shelburne fire, the 22-year-old charged with starting that fire, as an update there. The Halifax alehouse bouncer, who has been charged with manslaughter and criminal negligence, there's an administrative review taking place, and there was a question as to whether that review would be public. News on that. I want to talk a little bit about the Elver fishery, these baby eel fishery that has been very lucrative for some and controversial in a few different ways, which have legal aspects. We'll talk about that. The Online Harms Act, and some of that's working its way through Parliament now, and there's a thing that is done with legislation that the government always has to do and put out an explanation as to why this legislation is charter compliant. So I'll talk about that with respect to the Online Harms Act, that is the legislation controlling or purporting to control, seeking to control what takes place on the internet in Canada. And then before I get to the other two stories that I mentioned already, I'm going to mention there's an attempted antitrust lawsuit against the three major Canadian junior hockey leagues, Quebec, Ontario, and Western Hockey Leagues, filed in New York, and what that might mean for the future of major junior hockey in Canada. So, all right, well, let's get back and do some of these updates, which is starting with Michigan. This guy, James Crumley, father of Ethan Crumley, the shooter at the school in Michigan, several killed. He was charged along with his wife with manslaughter, and has been found, as she was by a jury, guilty. It's very unusual for parents to be found guilty along with their children. This was a teenager who was very troubled, had talked to his parents, complained to his parents about his troubles, his mental health. They responded by giving him a gun and very little supervision of it. He asked his father for help, said he wanted to go to the hospital. His father gave him some pills. The story didn't say what kind of pills, and said basically to suck it up and look after yourself. There was a meeting apparently at the school the morning of the shooting, and the recommendation at that time from school officials was get this guy out of here, get him home. The parents did not do that. They left him at the school, didn't check his backpack, didn't ask where the gun was, and then later the shootings took place. So this guy, James Crumley, has been convicted. His wife, Jennifer, has also been convicted, and she has an April 9th sentencing hearing, has been in custody, I think, since their arrests. And so we'll see what kind of sentence comes down with that. Usually fairly lengthy jail sentences in the United States compared to Canadian jurisprudence. All right. Not quite on the same level, but on the same vein. In C.P. Allen School, this teenager, like I said, he was 15 at the time, 16 now, has been going through the court system after these two stabbings. So there was, I think, a vice principal and an admin staff at the school. So he pled guilty. First of all, his lawyers had attempted to have the case thrown out because of two abusive process allegations. The allegations, the judge, Judge Elizabeth Buckle, highly regarded judge, found the allegations credible. One was that a sheriff had shared a photo of the youth, which you're not allowed to do. The sheriff was fired, shared a photo on social media. Sheriff was fired. So that was one thing the lawyers pointed to as an abuse of process. The other was that the police followed the kid in the ambulance to the hospital, were recording the entire time, and without having given proper notice or warnings or rights to the youth at the time. So that was also an abuse of process. Crown says they're not using any of that material against him, and so Judge Buckle determined that that wasn't enough to throw out the charges, very serious charges, of course. But abuse of process claims are often made, rarely successful, and there's a high bar to cross to have charges thrown out. So what happens though is, so as he pled guilty to aggravated assault, not attempted murder. Those charges will be dropped at the sentencing hearing. Apparently, what happened, so when you plead guilty, especially as a youth, the facts are often read in or laid out before the judge, so the judge feels confident accepting the plea, especially, like I say, in the case of a youth. Sometimes they'll wait till sentencing and then do the whole thing at once, the facts and the sentence recommendations. So what happens apparently here, according to the agreed facts, the youth had put some unauthorized posters. We don't know what was on the posters in the school, was taken into the vice principal's office or some office, was being told, disciplined for the poster issue, said at that point, my life is over, I might as well do this, and then got up and tried to stab this staff member, and then on the way out of the office, used the knife on an administrator, another staff person, then got outside and tried to put the knife to his own throat and harm himself. So obviously very troubled young person, and is going to need some help. It'll be interesting to see what the sentencing outcome is going to be here. We don't have a date for the sentence yet, but we do know that the prosecutor, this Jamie Van Wart, who people might remember from the Mass Casualty Commission, he was one of the lawyers for the commission, not one of the most prominent or top lawyers there, but he was featured throughout. He has said in the media that the Crown might be seeking an adult sentence in this case, which is a very surprising thing for the Crown to say. Inappropriate. I can't imagine the judge authorizing that after what this kid has gone through, and 15 years old, you know, clearly, like I say, troubled and needs rehabilitation and treatment more so than a punitive sentence. So we'll see where that goes. Not much was said about the possibility of an adult sentence. And to me, when you have an agreement on plea, as they've clearly come to between defense and Crown, it's very unusual that a sentencing discussion wouldn't be included in that. So I was surprised to see the prosecutor opining or speculating that they might still be seeking an adult sentence. All right, so we'll watch for that. Next update is this Shelburne fire, major fire last year, of course, across that part of the province. A 22-year-old has been charged with starting the fire and has entered a not guilty plea. As a date set to set the trial date, so we don't know the trial dates yet. It's, the dates will be set in, I think, a month or two. He has Phil Starr, defense lawyer from Yarmouth, as his lawyer, which is a good sign for him as the defendant. And so we'll watch for that too. But an update on that, that is a not guilty plea in that major case. Another Nova Scotia case that's gotten in the news, been in the news for a while, is this situation at the Ale House, the bar in Halifax. Bouncer from Alexander Levy, or Levi, from an incident where patron of the bar, Ryan Sawyer, was killed on December 24th, 2022. The bouncer has been charged with manslaughter and criminal negligence causing death and has pled not guilty to that. Jury trial is set for September of 2025. He and another bouncer, this Matthew Day, have also been charged with a separate incident of assault in October of 2022. But that's not what the story's about this week. It was that they have a disciplinary hearing under there's a disciplinary hearing under the Liquor Control Act for the Ale House itself over their failure to report the fact of these criminal charges. Two individuals, three sets of charges. And their lawyer, Victor Goldberg, who I don't know if it's coincidentally or not, I think is about a block away from the Ale House's office, and just no distance down the street. And applied to have this hearing, this Liquor Control Act hearing, done in confidence, in you know, away from the public view. CBC and the Globe and Mail opposed that, citing the open court principle and many sort of long-standing justice should be seen to be done sort of things. And the Liquor Control Act board agreed with that, and so the hearing is going to be public. Don't have a date for that yet, but we'll keep an eye out and see when that comes along. Should be interesting to see. Basically, they're charged with not, you know, not calling and letting the Liquor Control Board know about the criminal charges or any of the details associated with that. And so, who knows if there's actually going to be a hearing, or if that might be resolved, if it's that simple in a way. If they're so worried about publicity, I would suspect, reading between the lines, that there may be a plea agreement to be reached there, if they're, I say, worried about anything becoming public. The issue that Victor Goldberg had raised on the behalf was there's civil suits and there's going to be also these criminal charges, and so the publicity of the Liquor Control Act hearing might affect the right to fair trial in those other instances. Liquor Control Board disagreed. All right. Next Nova Scotia case or Nova Scotia situation is this elver fishery. So these are baby eels, tiny little things, and they are easy to catch. You can scoop them out of these rivers. People know where to go. Ship to China, where they're grown into full-size adults and sold there, harvested in China for the market there. Well, it's been very lucrative. There's about 1,100 legitimate elver fishers in Nova Scotia. Many more that are poaching, and DFO basically said they can't control the poaching. They can't monitor the number of rivers that are involved. They can't get people arrested, and you know, in a way that discourages people from poaching activity. So, what have they done in response to that? They have not said, well, we'll up our efforts to control poaching. No, they said they'll shut down the legitimate elver fishery. And so, in effect, I think in their mind, they'll say, well, this makes it easier to catch, because if anybody is doing elver fishing, then they're presumptively doing it illegally because nobody's allowed to do it legally. Okay, well, not sure that's the appropriate response to uncontrollable poaching activity, but that's what they're going to do. Plus, by the way, not only with the elver fishery, but this is a larger issue with First Nations Indigenous fishers. They're not being any clear guidelines as to what they can fish, whether they can fish, seasons, quotas. None of that is really settled. And it goes way back to the Donald Marshall decisions from the late 1990s, early 2000s, and the right to fish for a moderate livelihood. All those rights affirmed, affirming treaties from, years and decades and centuries ago, to have earn a moderate livelihood through resource management. Okay, well, that moderate livelihood, quote unquote, has not been defined, and successive governments have failed to define it. So there seems to be a right, in addition to whatever DFO regulates, for Indigenous fishers to go out and harvest the resource. However, we also see within the Indigenous communities, there are elders who are expressing concerns about resource depletion, saying, in effect, you're taking all the baby eels. How are there going to be enough adult eels for us to consume and use in ceremony, as has been done for generations? So, concerns on both sides. I mean, part of the trade-off with the Indigenous fishery and the right to a moderate livelihood and all that is the trust that is placed, I guess, or the faith in the expertise of the Indigenous fishermen and the communities to manage the resource and have a sense of a conservation mindset when it comes to that. Well, if that's not there, then that kind of undermines some of the right itself in a certain sense. But regardless, what this is really, it's a difficult thing for the fisheries officers. They don't know what to enforce. They don't know if they're allowed to or if they should be arresting people. They're not getting guidance from upper levels. So it seems to be a political issue where the moderate livelihood has not been defined. The seasons have not been settled upon. They're along with them in the Marshall decision. They said that DFO still has the right, the government still has the right to regulate. So, in other words, set seasons, set quotas. Okay. There doesn't seem to be a great deal of consultation or at least agreement on any of these issues. So, lots more work to do there. Now, you would expect, and you see this sometimes in the lobster fishery or other instances where Indigenous fishers are looking to assert their rights, that they'd just go out and do the thing, just like Donald Marshall did, following his lead, and get charged and assert your rights through the court system and deal with things that way. Well, that's expensive to do and needs support from the bands and the chiefs themselves. The Assembly of First of sorry of Nova Scotia Chiefs put out an announcement a couple of days ago saying they cannot fund every fisher that gets caught fishing elvers. So there's lots of bad cases. There's lots of cases that aren't good examples to use to fund and to try to put forward as sort of test cases to assert these rights. So what they're telling their fishers are basically hold off, I think, and we'll try to deal with this on an upper level and hopefully bring the fishery back in some form. Whether it's this season or not till next, we'll have to see. Okay, so the watch on the elver fishery. I know the Minister of Fisheries, this Diane Lebouthillier, is taking a lot of heat on both sides, and I think rightly so. I mean, they're just not doing the work to bring people together and resolve this issue. It seems eminently resolvable. So lots of work to do there. So we'll see what happens with the elver fishery over the course of the season. If people are still, there's a great deal of motivation to get out there and fish. It's $5,000 a kilo, and doesn't seem to be a lot of effort at the borders. This, in particular, in this case, it kind of reminds me actually of the car theft story. I don't know if people were listening Sunday night. We were talking about this on the Sunday night show, the number of cars that are being stolen across the country. Well, they're all leaving through borders, through ports, Montreal, Halifax, and there's no federal policing, or not effective federal policing, taking place at those locations. And so these cars are being sent off to all over the world, to Africa, to the Middle East, and all these other places, being resold. Well, that seems to be the case here with the elver fishery too. Planes flying out from Toronto with elvers destined for China, and nobody's really checking on them to see if they're legitimately caught. All right, so we'll watch the elver fishery over the course of the season. But that seems to be a common theme where the RCMP, supposed to be a federal police agency, is not policing the borders, the ports of entry for products and people. All right, so a few more stories there. So the next one I want to talk about, the national story, is this Online Harms Act. Now, I've talked about this a couple of times already, but what I was watching for over the past couple of weeks, was a document that comes out from the government whenever new legislation is introduced, which is a statement saying how the legislation is compliant with the charter. And still, this is why I mentioned at the first of the video that I was filming it on Thursday, maybe it'll come out tomorrow, I have my doubts. The government needs to put out a statement of compliance for the Online Harms Act. I have no doubt that the aspects of the act that deal with intimate images, non-consensual sharing of imagery, and photos of young people, all those things, luring of young people on the internet, all of that will pass and will be charter compliant. The free speech, the invasion, the free speech issues of monitoring hate speech, of sort of the future crime issue of sanctioning potential harms from potential speech, these things are not going to, they're not going to be charter compliant. So I'll be very interested to see how the government tries to explain that they are. All right, so we'll watch for that. Junior hockey. So talked about junior hockey. I talked about the other junior hockey situation with the sexual assault allegations in Kingston, Ontario, but the Kingston or Kitchener? Kitchener, Ontario. This is an antitrust lawsuit, or an attempt at an antitrust lawsuit. They're looking at making it a class action lawsuit, but there's a couple of issues. One is that it's being filed in New York by this organization. It's called the World Association of Ice Hockey Players. It's an international organization, has a North American branch, I guess. So what they're saying is that the three junior hockey leagues in Canada, Quebec Maritime League, the Ontario League, and the Western League, well, they have they divide up Canada by geography. If you're drafted as a 15-year-old into this league, you have to go where you're drafted. You don't have the choice. You can't just sign wherever you want to. You have to go someplace. Issues in Quebec where you may not speak the language, and lots of other stuff. And it's they're not paid. They're not like, the U.S. college players now are able to get some sponsorships and get some money. The other thing with junior hockey players, if you play a game of junior hockey, you cannot then go like one game and you're finished. You cannot play in the NCAA hockey leagues in the United States and earn a college degree at the same time. You can play Canadian university hockey. Anyway, there's lots of aspects to this, but this antitrust lawsuit, which is basically seeking to abolish the junior hockey draft, so midget and bantam hockey players couldn't be drafted, couldn't be forced to go to certain junior hockey programs, which is really essential for the viability of those leagues, teams that are in non major locations depend on being able to draft good players and maintain good programs in that way. Well, if you abolish that system, all of a sudden you're going to have, you know, powerful teams in big centers and struggling franchises in other places. Doesn't seem to be going too far, this antitrust lawsuit. First of all, the NHL, the junior hockey leagues have said that this World Association of Ice Hockey Players is not even a certified organization that represents any players. And be curious to see whether they can provide any evidence that, you know, the players themselves are completely against this system. You know, there's options. If you don't want to play in junior hockey, you can go to the States. You can play Canadian university hockey. You can go like Austin Matthews did and go to Europe and play a year of professional hockey until you're eligible for the NHL draft. So don't see this succeeding. I don't see it gaining a lot of traction, but I was interested to see that it was even filed. So according to the story, now this is about a month ago almost, when the when the lawsuit was filed. It doesn't seem like any defenses have yet been filed. Certainly there's been no updates on the story, so we'll keep an eye on that one if anything occurs. All right, two more stories. All right, this next one seems like a big one. It's Trudeau versus Richard Wagner, not Wagner, I don't think, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada. So a case came out a few months ago, and I guess now, from the Federal Court of Canada declaring that the government needed to urgently fill judicial vacancies across the country, that there's a serious shortage of judges at all levels, judges like chief judges in different provinces, but there's just not enough judges throughout Canada. So what happened is Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, who's also chair of the Judicial Council of Canada, Richard Wagner, wrote to the Prime Minister explaining this, saying, you know, in this province is not, there's this, you know, this many vacancies, this chief judge position has been vacant for 6 months, this one for 8 months, this is creating all kinds of problems, explained in great detail why the situation is a real urgent issue. And so that was taken to court, and the federal judge said, yes, I agree, but I'm not going to order the federal government to appoint a number of judges by a certain date, but the federal judge declared that it was a problem. So it was a declaration basically saying, you have to fix this urgently. Okay, so the government took a little bit of heat over that, and Justice Minister pledged to do better and all these things, but now they've appealed the decision. So this sets up quite a situation, because the nature of their appeal is basically to say the court made this decision without evidence, that they relied on hearsay from the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada. In other words, the Prime Minister is saying that the Chief Justice cannot be believed at face value, that what he says in his letter is hearsay. Well, technically that's true. It's not the Chief Justice maybe that counted up the number of judicial vacancies in Manitoba or Ontario or Nova Scotia and put that together. But it was told to him and he understood it to be true and he put it in a letter to the Prime Minister. So the government is now saying that that's hearsay and that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada is not an expert on these questions, which is an unbelievable thing to say in its simple form. Now, Chief Justice says there's lots of qualified candidates. That's not a problem. But the shortage is a major problem for a few reasons. First of all, as people would know, there's a framework on how long a case can take before it gets to court. It's called the Jordan framework. 18 months for things that are a summary conviction, less serious. 30 months for things that are indictable, more serious offenses. You have to get to court in that time frame. And so it has a cascading effect, because if those timelines are sort of hard and fixed, now, he also says in the letter that 22% of the cases, serious cases in Alberta, are beyond the Jordan time frame. So there's some serious cases that are not being heard, and people are getting off without a trial and having their charges stayed. Large number of cases under those circumstances. And then it also means that the judicial resources that are available are then focused almost exclusively on criminal cases, to the detriment of serious civil matters. So in other words, that civil cases are being neglected, so contract disputes, personal injury cases, lots of other cases. And so this fuels cynicism and undermines public trust in the justice system if they think certain kinds of cases aren't going to even make it to court and there's no way to have them resolved by courts. So it's a serious issue. I think the Federal Court of Appeal is going to have a look at this, and they're going to have to basically face the concept of whether the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada can be believed. I think they'll say he can. So this is a case I was saying to Paul and Jordan Sunday night. This is something that's interesting, not only for sort of law nerds on the division of powers between the Supreme Court and the legislature, but also I think the general public. This could be very interesting when it comes out. And I think there's some political risk too for the government here, which is, I mean, it was just a declaration that they had to hurry up and appoint some judges, and everybody kind of agreed that that was the right thing. And everybody in the public probably forgot all about it. Now the government, by appealing that decision, is bringing it back to public attention, and I think reminding the public that they messed up and that they are messing up by not speeding up this process. Another final thing I'll say on this is that one of the things in this letter the Chief Justice said was, you know, there's a new appointment process that this government brought in when they were elected 8 years ago, which was, you know, seen to be a further nonpartisan and all these things. It was a good process. And the Chief Justice says, boy, I would hate to see for that process to be undermined in the public's mind if they see it not working in the sense that it can appoint judges in a timely manner. So turning it back on the government to say, well, you know, get your work done, get this out there, or else people are going to start questioning the process by which judges are appointed, and I think rightly so. All right. Last thing I want to talk about, and we'll probably talk about this a little more, not this Sunday, but in the next Sunday night show, which is the police review in Nova Scotia. So the government announced that they were going to be reviewing, this is coming out of the Mass Casualty Commission, that there was a police review to be done. It was already kind of in the works before that. But Deloitte, formerly known as Deloitte & Touche, the accounting firm, now a business consulting / accounting firm, have been hired as an outside consultant to do this report due by April of 2025, i.e. just before the next provincial election, which is significant. So there will be a report coming out on Nova Scotia policing, whether this is, the way we have it now with the RCMP doing much of the rural areas and contract policing and some town and municipal forces intermixed, if that still makes sense, or if there's something, some different model that should be brought in. They'll, like I say, report in April of 2025. The election is going to be in July of 2025. So that means the report's going to come out. It'll be discussed in the public. There will be no legislation to enact whatever the recommendation might be, but it hopefully will become at least an election issue. And then if the public supports the recommendations from the report, then the government, when it comes in, re-elected or newly elected, would maybe do something in the fall session of 2025 to enact whatever the recommendations from Deloitte and the group might be. Well, there's decent-looking, prominent individuals in the group. Lindell Smith is one of the co-chairs, councillor in Halifax, former chair of the Halifax Board of Commissioners, African Nova Scotian individual as well, so that's a helpful thing. Haley Crichton, executive director of the Department of Justice Public Safety and Security Division, again, senior official within the Justice Department, but I would say somebody during the Mass Casualty Commission who several times was a witness or a was providing input and basically said the system's working as it is. So I'm not sure her presence, certainly as a co-chair, is particularly helpful. Rosalind Penfound, who's kicked around different positions within the government. Wayne Hamilton, interim executive director of Nova Scotia Association of Black Social Workers, great organization. Juanita Spencer, CEO of Nova Scotia Federation of Municipalities. Thierno Diallo, Atlantic Canada Advisory Officer for National Council of Canadian Muslims. Don't know him. Don Ferris, Executive Director, Cumberland County Transition House. Involved in the EFRI. Shelley Martin, Governance Director of the Confederation of Mainland Mi'kmaq. Colleen Bell, Coordinator of Welcoming Services, Immigration Services Association. Chief Dave McNeil from the Truro Police Service. Good appointment there. Mapfumo Chidzonga, Senior Engagement Strategist of the Office of Equity and Anti-Racism. Wayne Talbot, former President, Canadian Association of Police Governance and Chair of the Truro Police Commission. Superintendent Dan Morrow, the District Commander for Southwest Nova Scotia, RCMP. Sherry Taylor, Executive Director of the Leaside Society in Port Hawkesbury. I know Sherry quite well. She'll be a good addition. Anise McKay, Provincial Coordinator, Nova Scotia Rainbow Action Project, and Rob Morris, Director of Residential Programs of Phoenix Youth. So, a diverse group of people involved in this review. Hopefully, it brings out something substantial, good recommendations, and so we'll wait to see if the work is done, if it's any of it is public, if there's a lot of public consultations. Hopefully, there will be, and we'll see some major changes to policing in Nova Scotia. This is an opportunity, and maybe the last best chance to make major changes, so I will be watching for that for sure. All right, went a little longer than normal, but I missed last week, so a few extra things to cover, and there'll be no Sunday night show this week. Jordan is away, but he'll be back next week after that, and we'll cover all the stories that need discussing. All right, so again, thanks everybody for watching, and thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.